Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241, and it's October, let me check, 13th? Yeah, October 13th. And I think you had you didn't have a test last time, but you're getting your test back in lab if you want to take a look at them. If not, come see me during office hours. We can go over them if you have questions or whatever. But I do have some comments, and that is, please try to put your Scantrons. This is not so much of a problem in this class, but it was a huge problem in my anatomy classes because I have like 6 or 7 sections of anatomy. Try to put your Scantron in the correct lab day and time, right? Because it's really hard for me to go back through everybody's labs and find out where your grades belong. So that was a problem. And the other thing, some people change their names in the middle of the semester. So use the name that you are registered with, even though it's not your current name, okay? Because I have a hard time figuring that one out, too. And there are a couple other problems with people putting their wrong names on there in a different pile or whatever, and that just kind of slows everything down. So if you could be really careful about that, think about your lab day and time before you even start the test. I know because after the test, it might be too late to figure all that out. I realize you're pretty fatigued after a test, right? So. And also mark that on your Scantron. That would be helpful. But everybody's got their test back and in the right lab section now, so that worked out just fine. Last time we talked about the autonomic nervous system, but the projector wasn't showing the slide, so I put some excellent artwork on the board, but I still want to go back and look at some pictures that you have in your book nonetheless. All right, so it's important, I think, that you remember some of your anatomy and make sure you know the difference between an autonomic pathway and a somatic pathway, what that means. So I tell you what is a somatic pathway? Voluntary. It's voluntary. It's going to what kind of effector organ? Skeletal muscle, yeah. As opposed to an autonomic pathway, goes to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And the anatomy is inherently different, right? So somatic nerve impulses leave through cranial nerves and throughout the whole extent of the spinal cord. All the different spinal nerves carry both sensory and motor information. The autonomic outflow pathways are quite a bit different, though, right? They're highly selective. And I tell you what, let's just start with the general difference between a somatic and an autonomic pathway. And this is going to be pretty important in terms of understanding the role of various neurotransmitters. So a somatic pathway, I'm not even going to boot up the PowerPoint program, unless you can't see it. Oh, maybe I'll turn some of the lights off. So that might help a little bit. Okay. Because I want to flip through these slides pretty fast. So here you see a typical somatic pathway, and the motor neuron cell body, right, is in the anterior gray horn, and it just leaves through the ventral root, right, and it's just one motor neuron that goes all the way to the effector organ, right, without synapsing anywhere. So it's just a single motor neuron. And you might want to know what kind of neuron that is. What are some different kinds of neurons by shape? You have multipolar, you have bipolar, you have unipolar. If you want to say pseudo-unipolar, that's fine with me. All right, but this kind of neuron right here, a motor neuron, is typically a multipolar neuron. It's a classical shape of a neuron that we all study early on. All right, as opposed to an autonomic pathway, how many neurons does it take to get from spinal cord to the effector organ? It's no longer one, right? But it's two. There's a preganglionic and a postganglionic, and the postganglionic fiber has to synapse someplace, and that means that there is a second nerve cell body we have right here, and there's going to be a group of them someplace in the peripheral nervous system, and that's what we call a ganglion, right? So a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system is a ganglion. And for the autonomic nervous system, there's always going to be a ganglion someplace because there's always going to be a pre- and post-synaptic cell. Okay. All right, so then let's talk about how many different kinds of autonomic nervous systems are there. There are basically two. right? And they're called parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, and you should have on the tip of your tongue what the general theme of these nervous systems are. So if you're going to think of the sympathetic nervous system, what generally is it responsible for? Yeah, the fight or flight response, and parasympathetic is for the rest and digest is probably the best way of thinking of these. And what's the relationship? In most cases, maybe 99% of the time, the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic going to be antagonistic to each other. Okay, some organs only receive single innervation, many receive dual innervation, and if that's the case, if it's dually innervated, it's antagonistic to each other, except for maybe one or two cases that I can think of. Okay. All right, and then the typical outflow pattern. Where do we have it? Oh, yeah, you should be familiar with this from anatomy. The outflow pathways for the sympathetic, right, is what we call thoracolumbar, and you can see that in red. How am I doing? Fantastic. Okay. So outflow for sympathetic pathways, you see, exits the spinal cord only from T1 to L2, and then it passes through the sympathetic chain ganglia where it can synapse, right? Or can it pass all the way through to a collateral ganglion someplace? But in every case, except for one, there's going to be a ganglion between the spinal cord and the effector organ. Right? And the neurotransmitter in all of these ganglia, whether it's in the sympathetic chain or collateral ganglia or prevertebral ganglion, is going to be acetylcholine. Right? So the preganglionic fiber is always a cholinergic fiber, but in the sympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic fiber is always going to be what we call adrenergic, so it's going to be releasing norepinephrine. Okay. And these receptors are of the nicotinic type within the ganglion cells. All right, so that's kind of similar to the parasympathetic nervous system, except for the outflow. The outflow for parasympathetic nervous system is what? Through cranial nerves and sacral nerves. So we say the outflow is cranial sacral. That's the only way parasympathetic information can reach effector organs. And the preganglionic fibers are relatively long. They go all the way to the effector organ, but there's going to be a small ganglion on the surface or within the effector organ so that the postganglionic fiber is relatively short. Both the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber for a parasympathetic nervous system are cholinergic, which means what? They release acetylcholine, right? And the receptors on the on the postganglionic cell are nicotinic receptors, but on the effector organ, they're muscarinic. And it can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on the kind of receptor that's there. And you should have an idea of why it is that acetylcholine, a single neurotransmitter, can either be excitatory or inhibitory, because it depends on the kind of receptor that is stimulated. So tell me about some different kinds of receptors in terms of the channel that is being operated, opening. It could be, maybe, if it's excitatory, what kind of channel is it going to be? A sodium channel, right? And if it's inhibitory, what kind of channel is going to open up? Could be chloride or it could be potassium, right? Both will be inhibitory. That will hyperpolarize the cell, move it farther away from threshold, and that will be inhibitory on that particular cell. All right, so you see a couple, you see the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system, different neurotransmitters that are used. And this is a pretty good slide that you should look over, okay, because it shows some of the antagonistic properties of sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. All right, let me angle this up a little bit. okay, so in the eye, the sympathetic innervation will dilate the pupil. That makes sense, right? When you're in a stressful situation, your eye should dilate so more light enters your eye so that you have faster response time and you can see better. Parasympathetic will constrict the pupil when you're in a restful state. Let's see what else is a good one. Let's look at some digestive system. Salivary glands, right? Sympathetic, we see, Well, it decreases the secretion of saliva, so it inhibits salivation. And what about the parasympathetic? Increases. It's going to be antagonistic. And as a matter of fact, if you look at all of the digestive system organs, you can see that it kind of follows that same trend where the parasympathetic is stimulatory, increases motility, increases secretion, as opposed to the heart. It flips back the other way, but in every case, the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic will be opposite or antagonistic to each other. Okay, so sympathetic stimulation on the heart increases the heart rate. Increases heart rate, increases the force of contraction, and it also increases the rate of conduction within the heart through the conducting system within the heart. But parasympathetic, on the other hand, is going to be inhibitory on the heart, decreases the rate, the heart rate, and decreases the rate of conduction through the heart of electrical impulses through the heart. And the other strange thing, though, notice that it has no effect on force of contraction or strength of contraction. Can anybody remember what we call adjustments to heart rate? What do we call an agent that can adjust the heart rate? Okay. All right. I'll relate that to receptors maybe in just a little bit. But there are two terms that are important. One has to do with rate. We call that chronotropy. And the other one has to do with force of contraction, and that is inotropy. Inotropy. Right? So sympathetic stimulation is both a positive chronotropic agent and a positive inotropic agent. It will increase both. Parasympathetic, on the other hand, is a negative agent for chronotropy. It slows the heart rate down, but it doesn't affect the force of contraction one way or the other. All right? So I do want you to know those terms and how it relates to the heart. Chronotropy and inotropy. Chrono, like a chronograph is a timepiece, so it has something to do with rate. So you know what? Let me just jot that down. Chronotropy and inotropy. Chronotropy has to do with what? Rate. And inotropy has to do with force of contraction. Force of contraction. Two independent concepts, which will probably be important when we get to the heart. Okay. So one particular place that I see right here where the effects of parasympathetic and sympathetic are not necessarily antagonistic to each other, they're complementary to each other, and that is in the penis, where sympathetic effect causes ejaculation. Parasympathetic doesn't inhibit ejaculation, but it's important for a totally different kind of event, and that is erection, right? So erection and ejaculation go together, and in this particular case, the autonomic nervous system, right, enhances both of those, right? It's stimulatory to both of those effects, right? So in that particular case, it's not purely antagonistic. All right, here is a good exam figure that you should be aware of, and it shows outflow. Okay, what kinds of outflow does it show? Autonomic, right? Autonomic. And what are the two divisions of the autonomic system? Sympathetic and parasympathetic, right? So here is cranial sacral is what kind of outflow? That's parasympathetic. And you see the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fibers. At the ganglion, clearly you see the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, and then at the postganglionic fiber, the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine once again. But for the sympathetic nervous system, right, we see that the preganglionics, relatively short fibers, they are cholinergic fibers because they release acetylcholine, but the postganglionic fibers release norepinephrine, right? So that's a nice distinction between the, or with the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, there's only one scheme that's a little bit different. Okay, and all right, let me just say something about the general workings of the sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system, when it becomes triggered into activation, right, it has a very broad range of effects everywhere. The whole sympathetic nervous system becomes activated at one time, and that's due to the divergence and convergence of the pathways. Right, that's one thing, as opposed to the parasympathetic nervous system, where the effects can be very localized on one particular target tissue. Right, so we don't say there's mass activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's highly selective, so you can activate one pathway without activating any other pathway. That's not really true for the sympathetic nervous system. Another good example that shows mass activation, but also shows an interesting anatomical deviation from the usual two-neuron outflow pathway that we see, has to do with the adrenal gland. And here we can see, and the adrenal gland is part of a sympathetic control in the body, where the preganglionic fiber goes all the way through, passes right through the sympathetic chain, goes to the adrenal gland, which sits on top of the kidney, okay? And so the adrenal gland is acting like the postganglionic fiber or the postganglionic cell in a typical sympathetic outflow pathway. But the cells of the adrenal medulla don't conduct electrical impulses to an effector organ someplace. Right? When they are depolarized from the preganglionic fiber, the cells of the adrenal medulla directly release norepinephrine and another related compound, epinephrine, outside their cells, are secreted outside the cell, but it's a highly vascular organ. There are a lot of capillaries, so those neurotransmitters basically then are absorbed, diffused into the capillary, and so now they're in your blood, and where do they go once they're in your blood? They go everywhere, right? So now you have high levels of epinephrine and norepinephrine circulating everywhere in your body, binding to receptors everywhere in your body, which is signaling what kind of response? Okay, fight or flight response is kind of what I was thinking. All right, so increased heart rate, increased force of contraction of your heart, plus all the other sympathetic effects that you could look at in that particular table. All right, so the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber in a typical outflow pathway, but they're not really carrying electrical signals like a neuron does. All right, so the cells of the adrenal medulla release a signaling molecule directly into the blood, and those signaling molecules go to a distant target tissue where they bind to a receptor to cause some kind of specific response, like increase in heart rate, increase force of contraction. So in that particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are really not acting like neurotransmitters. They're acting more like something we consider a hormone. So a hormone is something that's secreted by a ductless gland, gets picked up by the blood, and then it's the blood that delivers those signaling molecules all over the body, where they have to bind to a receptor someplace, which then causes a change in metabolism or physiology of those distant cells. Okay, so the adrenal medulla is a perfect example of a site where we can't really distinguish between is it nervous system or is it endocrine system. It's the interface between the endocrine system and the nervous system right there. So this is really what? The neuroendocrine system right here. So sometimes neurotransmitters can be used as hormones. So that's a nice distinguishing feature. How does this preganglionic fiber get all the way to the adrenal medulla? This is just a really quick review of sympathetic, the architecture of the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so here we see a sympathetic fiber passing right through the sympathetic chain without synapsing. It doesn't go to, doesn't synapse in a prevertebral ganglion or a collateral ganglion, passes right through, goes to the adrenal gland. So what do we call a nerve fiber that passes right through the sympathetic chain and goes to a collateral ganglion someplace? Sometimes you hear this nerve, and you might know a lot about nerves, But a lot of times in anatomy, you don't really have this, the name of this nerve on the tip of your tongue, even though probably all of you have heard this particular nerve, name of this nerve, right? It's going to be a splanchnic nerve, splanchnic. So a splanchnic nerve, right, is a pre-ganglionic, it carries pre-ganglionic fibers that pass right through the sympathetic chain to either a collateral ganglion or to the adrenal medulla. Right, so splanchnic nerves don't carry or don't have fibers, postganglionic fibers in them. And you have a couple in your body. Okay, you have like this greater splanchnic nerve, the lesser splanchnic. Okay. So if you ever hear that term splanchnic, what is one way that maybe you should think about a splanchnic nerve? What's it doing in your body? Is it a somatic neuron or an autonomic neuron?
Autonomic.
It's autonomic, okay. And what kind of autonomic? What are your choices? Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Splanchnic nerve is a sympathetic nerve, right? And so what's it going to be responsible for producing in your body? In a really general, nice general way of thinking about it. Fight or flight response, right? Okay. All right, so let's see. We talked about various kinds of neurotransmitters. Autonomic nervous system, we see that the synapses are quite a bit different compared to a somatic nerve ending because we have varicosities, right? We have swellings along the whole axon, and these swellings contain synaptic vesicles that release neurotransmitter. And for instance, and so we call these synapses en passant. And the effector organ will receive parasympathetic and sympathetic. So the effector organ, unlike a skeletal muscle, right, will then look at the amount of stimulation from a sympathetic nerve and compare it to the amount of stimulation from a parasympathetic nerve and then make a decision on what to do. So effector organs of the autonomic nervous system can integrate information from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. And if this is a smooth muscle right here, it can make up its own mind whether it should contract or not based on what two effects. The amount of stimulation from the parasympathetic nervous system and the amount of stimulation from the sympathetic nervous system, and it can make up its own mind. And that's really a radical departure from skeletal muscle. Can a skeletal muscle ever make up its own mind whether it should contract or not?
No.
Absolutely not. As soon as it receives acetylcholine from a motor neuron, it's going to contract. It can't decide based on various kinds of inputs, right? It just contracts. So that's a big difference between autonomic effector organs and somatic effector organs like skeletal muscle. So here's a pretty good table. I think we talked about this before, all right, that shows we have different kinds of adrenergic receptors, right? We have two different kinds of alpha receptors, and in this class we're not going to really talk about the alpha 2 receptors, but we are going to talk about alpha 1. Alpha 1 typically are stimulatory. Yes. To some degree, yes. So let's talk about that. All right, so let's make some generalization of what these receptors do. Okay, I'll give you, and I have another slide that will help you understand what these receptors do. Okay, what is important to know is that adrenergic receptors have two major subtypes, which are alpha and beta. Okay, and furthermore, there are subtypes of those subtypes. There's alpha 1, alpha 2, and there's beta 1, beta 2. Okay, all of these receptors are work through G-protein coupled receptors, right? They're not just simple ion channels like nicotinic receptors, but they work through G-protein coupled receptors. okay, so they transduce the signal from outside the cell. The G-protein coupled receptors transduce a signal from outside the cell into a signal inside the cell. So the signal outside the cell is what we always call, generally speaking, the first messenger, And the signal inside the cell, which is developed through the use of that G-protein coupled receptor, is always what we're going to call a second messenger. And I think on the last test, you had a fairly sophisticated scheme, right, that you, it was even on the test that showed a G-protein coupled receptor. All right, so second messengers can have a couple different forms. We're learning more and more about them all the time. Okay, one important one is cyclic AMP. That's when ATP is broken down into AMP, but it forms a nice cyclic compound. That's a very important second messenger. And all beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. Okay, while the alpha receptors, whether it's 1, 2, or any of the subdivisions of any kind of alpha receptor, is going to use calcium as a second messenger. And that calcium can be released from sarcoplasmic reticulum or can be actually allowed to diffuse into the cell from an extracellular source. Okay, so alpha 1, generally speaking, you're going to want to say that it is excitatory, right? That it depolarizes a cell. And if it's a muscle cell, it's going to cause that muscle cell to contract as a result of that. So if we look at alpha 1s, we see that alpha 1 in the eye causes contraction of the fibers of the iris, in particular radial fibers, that's going to dilate the pupil. We're going to look and see how that mechanism works in the next chapter. Alpha 1 on arterioles, basically, no matter where those are, constrict arterioles. All right, so alpha 1 is stimulatory. All right, let's go to beta receptors. We have beta 1 receptors in the heart. Beta 1 receptors, you can see what's the effect. It's going to increase heart rate and contraction. So it's a positive chronotropic effect and a positive inotropic effect. So beta 1 receptor, would you say what is generally inhibitory or stimulatory? I mean, let's say inhibitory or excitatory. Excitatory, right? And what's our last kind of receptor? We see beta 2. All right, so where do we see beta 2 receptors? Well, we see beta 2 in bronchioles, smooth muscle of the airways, the microscopic airways in the lungs. Okay, and we also have some beta 2 receptors on arterioles. All right, and in every case, you see the primary effect is going to be dilation. So how does a tube dilate? When a muscle contracts that's around it, or when that muscle relaxes? When it relaxes, that tube is going to dilate. That's going to increase flow, whether it's blood flow or air flow through a bronchiole. So beta 2 receptors cause inhibition. All right, so they inhibit the contraction of smooth muscle. All right, so those are really the three effects that I want you to really appreciate from this table. All right. And so how can you remember that beta 1 it works on the heart and beta 2 is the lungs? Because you got two lungs and you've got two hearts, right? No, you only got one heart. Okay, so heart, beta 1, because you only got one of them. Think of it that way. There's no rhyme or reason to that. It just happens to work as a little aid for remembering the difference between beta 1 and beta 2. All right, so if somebody has bronchospasm, their bronchioles are contracting. Maybe they have asthma, emphysema, inhaled some noxious chemicals, and you're having trouble breathing because bronchioles are contracted. What kind of agent would you like to use to dilate their airway so that you can breathe? What should you inhale?
Bronchodilator.
A bronchodilator, which is what kind of agonist? What kind of receptor is it going to work on? It's going to work on a beta 2, and is it going to inhibit or stimulate a beta 2? Okay, you know what? It's going to stimulate a beta 2, because when you stimulate a beta 2, you cause those muscles to relax, and then they dilate. All right, and if you use a beta 2, do you have to worry about blowing somebody's heart up? Because the heart doesn't have beta 2, right? So if you have a nice agent that only targets beta 2 receptors, you don't have to worry about the effects on somebody's heart. And so that's the goal of pharmaceutical companies, is not to design a drug that's just like norepinephrine that will stimulate alpha receptors and beta receptors. all over the body, but will have just a selective effect on a particular receptor, like a beta 2. Okay. All right, so here is another exam figure that kind of just pounds in the concepts of the different kinds of receptors. So another good question would be, well, how can a single neurotransmitter have various effects all over the body? How come it can be stimulatory in one organ, or excitatory in one organ and inhibitory in another? How can one neurotransmitter have different effects in different organs of your body? Because different organs will have different receptors. And those different G-protein coupled receptors act through different second messengers, and those different second messengers can open up different kinds of ion channels. And depending on the ion channel, it can be a depolarizing channel or a hyperpolarizing channel. Okay. So here we see, what do we see right here? I see two neurons in every case. So do you see any somatic pathways right here? No, these are all autonomic, right? Because a somatic would require just a single neuron from central nervous system to the effector organ. See, these are all autonomic pathways. And let's look over here. This first pathway I see is releasing acetylcholine from the postganglionic fiber. So immediately you should know what kind of pathway is this. It's parasympathetic. And I see norepinephrine on these pathways right here, so that's got to be sympathetic, because that's basically how they work. Okay. And in the ganglion, acetylcholine is used in every particular case. And in every particular case, it's not a G-protein coupled receptor, it's always a nicotinic receptor, right, within the ganglion. So all autonomic preganglionics are what we call cholinergic, right? The postganglionic are cholinergic only for parasympathetic nervous system. And in the sympathetic nervous system, all postganglionic fibers are adrenergic. All right, so let's look at, the effector organs for parasympathetic nervous system don't have nicotinic receptors, they have muscarinic receptors. And these muscarinic receptors can be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on what kind of channels they open up. And that will produce those parasympathetic effects on that particular effector organ. All right, sympathetic, what do we got? Alpha-1, beta-1, beta-2. All right, so an alpha-1 receptor is going to be excitatory, causing constriction of smooth muscle, like vasoconstriction of blood vessels. Beta-1 increases heart rate and contractility, right? And beta-2 is going to be inhibitory on smooth muscles of the lungs. It's going to be a bronchodilator when they are stimulated. Okay, so this is a particularly good figure that you got to practice labeling, and then I think it will be pretty easy to remember the different kinds of receptor types and where they work. Okay. So, maybe this was the last slide. This is just kind of a review, right? I don't think I have this as an exam figure, but maybe I should, because it really is a nice synopsis of everything. Here we see, what kind of receptor does this look like to you? Does it look like a G-protein coupled receptor?
No,
this is just a nice, simple ligand-gated channel. When it binds to acetylcholines, this channel opens up. The primary effect is depolarization, because more sodium enters the cell. All right, and that's going to raise the membrane potential, RMP, toward threshold, right? So this is an excitatory kind of ligand-gated channel right here. All right, so where do we see this? All autonomic ganglia, all neuromuscular junctions in a somatic pathway, and some central nervous system pathways, right? All right, over here. But what about a postganglionic fiber? Would a postganglionic fiber release acetylcholine and stimulate a nicotinic type receptor? No, there. In every case, it's going to be a muscarinic. All right, so that's what we see over here. We have G-protein coupled receptors, and these are muscarinic receptors. When acetylcholine binds, It can be produce inhibition by opening up a potassium channel, or it could produce excitation by maybe closing a potassium channel or opening up a sodium channel, or maybe both of these together, right, will rapidly depolarize the cell and have it reach threshold. All right, so this is a nice comparison between nicotinic versus muscarinic type receptors. All right. I don't think I'm going to talk about the different kinds of muscarinic receptors that there are, but it's important for you to know the different kinds of adrenergic receptors. All right, so that's kind of another just quick review of the autonomic nervous system. All right, so hopefully you can recall some of its anatomy. That will help you understand some of the physiology with the different kinds of receptors because of the different kinds of neurotransmitters that are used. All right, so let's move on to the sensory chapter. I think you've had a couple sensory labs already. So you might be fairly familiar with some of these things. Okay, so in order for you to be able to communicate with the environment, to perceive the environment around you, right, what do you have to have? You got to have a receptor for that particular modality of energy, right? So in order for you to appreciate light, you need to have eyes, for instance, right? In order for you to perceive changes in temperature, you need temperature receptors. Is anybody cold in here? You are cold a little bit. Okay. I think the temperature is pretty good, but I'm moving around a little bit. All right, so it's the job of these receptors to take that energy. Is that a question up there? No? Okay, to take that energy and convert it into the language of your nervous system. So what's the language of your nervous system? What is your brain? How does your brain understand something? And it's amazing, we can't hear this, all this activity in our brains, but it's just what? A series of little pops or ticks, because action potentials are very, very short-lived. Right? So the language of your nervous system is action potentials. And the way that information is understood, it's by how many action potentials are reaching a certain part of your brain in a certain period of time. Right? If there are many thousands of action potentials reaching an area of your brain, then it's a very intense signal. But if you only have a couple of action potentials reaching your brain, it's what? A very, very low intensity kind of signal. Right? So we call that frequency coding. Nonetheless, it's the job of a receptors to change environmental stimuli into action potentials and then send those action potentials to the central nervous system, in particularly the brain. So each type of receptors responds to only a particular modality efficiently. Okay, some respond to sound, some respond to light, some respond to pressure. Right, so different modalities then are perceived because action potentials go to different parts of the brain. And I think in anatomy, you learned what some of the different functional areas of the brain are. So if there are action potentials that reach the occipital lobe, what is going to be your perception? Are you going to taste something, or are you going to hear something, or are you going to feel something, or what? You're going to see something, right? Whether it's real or not, if there are action potentials in the occipital lobe, then you're going to have the perception of vision, right, or seeing something. And if it goes to the temporal lobe, you're going to be hearing something, whether there's sound in the room or not, right? And if there's sensation on the surface of your body, action potentials will go to, does anybody know where sensation on the surface of your body ends up? Okay, that's the primary sensory cortex. That's going to be like the post-central gyrus, that's going to be the parietal lobe, okay? All right, well, maybe we'll review some of those things as we go through this particular chapter, all right? So you perceive certain modalities depending on what part of the brain is receiving action potentials, and that's coming from various stimuli all around you. All right, so we need to talk a little bit about different kinds of sensory receptors. You have some sensory receptors all over your body, right? And some of these can be simple dendritic nerve endings of neurons, or some can be really complicated encapsulated nerve endings. All right, and here I see some free nerve endings around a hair follicle. There are other free nerve endings around inside the cell. And free nerve endings are responsible for pain primarily, as well as temperature. Free nerve endings for pain and temperature. And, for instance, if I take an ice cube and put it on your forehead, can you tell that it's cold or hot? Some of you don't know. Ah, we should put that in the lab exercise for this week. We put an ice cube on your forehead. Can you tell that it's cold? Yeah, absolutely. Or if we put it on your back, can you tell it's cold? Yeah, or your kneecap, or the back of your forearm, right? So no matter where we put that ice cube, you can tell that it's cold. So you have temperature receptors where in your body? Everywhere, all over the place, right? And so because you have receptors for temperature, hot and cold, all over the place, then maybe the discrimination will be a little bit different in different parts of the body. But nonetheless, you have temperature sensing ability all over the body. We say that that is a general sense. So anytime that you have receptors for a particular mode of energy all over your body, we say it's what? A general sense. As opposed to other kinds of sensory receptors, you only have maybe in one or two locations. Right? So who can tell me of a sense that you have only in one location? Smell. You can only use your nose. And taste, right? So smell and taste are not general senses. Those are what we call special senses. All right? Other special sense modalities would be vision and hearing, and other organs associated with your inner ear that are important for equilibrium, right? Those would be special senses. But all of these other senses are general senses. And here is an interesting one to consider. And that is, in anatomy, I think you learned about muscle spindles and Golgi tendon apparatus, right, that measure muscle tension and tendon stretch all over your body, because every muscle, every tendon, and even ligaments have these things to measure how much tension is being produced by muscles when they contract, right? So would you consider that a special sense or a general sense? Oh, before you answer that, let me say, what is that sense called when it that your body can appreciate, even unconsciously, muscle tension? Okay, muscle contraction, it's called proprioception. Proprioception. It's kind of an oddball kind of term, but you should be aware of it. So here's the question. Is proprioception a general sense or a special sense, based on the definition of special and general? Okay. Proprioception sounds, by the name, special. But where do you have these receptors? All over your body. So what does that mean? It is a general sense, right? So it's still a general sense. So right now we're going to talk about some general sensations like temperature, pain, touch, pressure, vibration, and even proprioception. Okay. All right. So we can also group receptors according to the type of stimulus that they transduce. All right. So a chemoreceptor is going to transduce the concentration of chemicals. Right? And what does transduce mean? Change from a concentration of chemicals into what? Action potentials that go to certain parts of your brain, so that certain parts of your brain actually know what the concentration of acid is, or carbon dioxide, or glucose. Right? So you have to have these receptors to know what the concentrations of these chemicals are. But do you know what that concentration is inside your body? These are all unconscious, right? Unfortunately, they're not shared. So if you wanted to know your blood glucose levels, you can't just look at some readout in your mind's eye someplace and know what it is, right? You actually have to measure it. But there are places in your body that do know, but it doesn't rise to your consciousness, right? Photoreceptors transduce light energy into action potentials. Fortunately, that raises to the level of consciousness so that you can perceive, so that you can navigate around in your environment. Thermoreceptors respond to temperature changes. You have thermoreceptors in your brain, which you're not aware of what your body temperature is, but your brain knows what your body temperature is. But you also have thermoreceptors on your skin. And those, of course, you can tell if it's hot or cold. And we play around with those in lab this week, or maybe some of you last week. What's today, Tuesday? No, this week. Everybody's getting it this week. Okay. Mechanoreceptors respond to deformation. When the cell membrane changes shape, all right, then certain ion channels are going to open up. Maybe sodium channels, which will be stimulatory. Maybe potassium channels, which will be inhibitory on these receptors. Nociceptors are receptors for pain. And, of course, these are, I need a sign-in sheet. Thanks for reminding me, whoever walked in. Okay, I know who that is, but I can't say your name. Okay, and I know where you live, so. Okay, so somebody should start a sign-in sheet and start to pass it around. Oh, you already got it? Okay, fantastic. All right, we don't need another one. Nociceptors are responsible for pain. They can, they respond to pain. And what is pain? What kind of signal is pain? What is it measuring in your body? It's measuring tissue damage. Okay? And so when you receive painful stimulus, you know a certain part of your body is damaged. And then, of course, you can employ your consciousness to do what? Remove yourself from that source of damage, from that damaging stimulus, right? So nociceptors are very important. Not that we want to experience pain, but it's necessary, because if you don't have nociceptors or pain receptors, like after you go to a dentist, right? And we probably all have experienced that. What does a dentist say after they've used anesthesia? Don't go have lunch anywhere, because what could you do while eating your lunch? You could chew your tongue completely up, right? And not even know it, right? So nociceptors are very important for protecting your body. And then lastly, the one that we talked about already are proprioceptors. Golgi, that signal position and tension measurements from all over your body. Then these measurements are shared with your cerebellum, so that we more or less act fairly coordinated when we're walking and sitting and doing other kinds of activities. Okay. We can also characterize sensory receptors, all right, into, well, we talked about this, general versus special, all right. A general receptor, sometimes we maybe consider these cutaneous receptors, because most of them are located in the skin, except for the proprioceptors are deep all over the body. All right, so general just means that you have receptors everywhere in the body. Special means that they're located in one or two locations, but the organ responsible is fairly complicated. It's a very sophisticated, anatomically complex organ that is responsible for a certain modality, like hearing, sight, equilibrium, which is associated with the ear, taste. What else? Taste, smell. Okay. So those are the everyday kind of language. We'll learn their proper physiologic terms in a little bit. Okay. Sensory receptors can be broken down into two types. Right, there are tonic receptors versus phasic receptors. Tonic receptors respond at a constant rate if the stimulus is not changed. Right, so as soon as you turn a stimulus on, and as long as the stimulus is applied in over time and the intensity doesn't change, then the rate of action potentials that are going to go to the brain does not change as well. Right, and as soon as you turn the stimulus off, what happens to action potentials going to the brain? They stop immediately at that point in time. So this is what we call a tonic receptor. There are other kinds of receptors that are phasic receptors. They respond very rapidly and powerfully when the stimulus is first applied. Right, and then so you have a high rate of action potentials reaching the brain when the stimulus is turned on, but if it's left on, notice what happens to the frequency of action potentials being sent to the brain. It decreases, right? And so then your brain loses interest and loses track of that particular kind of stimulus, right? We call that adaptation. And I think you dealt with some of these kinds of receptors this week in lab, okay? Some of examples of phasic receptors would be, for instance, touch. We have touch receptors. A good example is when you get up and get dressed in the morning, you can feel yourself putting clothes on, right? You feel the clothes going on your body, and then after a couple seconds, probably less than a minute, you don't feel like you're wearing shoes. You don't feel the clothes on your body. So touch receptors are phasic receptors. They adapt very quickly. Smell is also a receptor that adapts, right? You might, what's a building that has a characteristic smell to it? Libraries. That's a perfect example. As soon as you walk in the library, even with your eyes closed, you could say, oh, this is a library, no matter what library you walk into. Okay, probably because of all the paper products or whatever chemicals they use in papers. All right, but after you're there for 10 minutes, all right, if you close your eyes and smell, you probably can't even smell that particular smell anymore. All right, so the sense of olfaction, right, is due to phasic receptors as well. Okay, but for tonic receptors, of course, you don't want pain receptors to adapt, because you should always be aware of damaging stimulus to your body. So those are tonic receptors. They don't go away. All right, touch does, even deep touch and vibration does. All right, so there's a law of specific nerve energies that says that a receptor might send action potentials to the brain, but there's only one kind of energy that is efficient in stimulating that receptor. So every receptor responds best to one modality of energy. And that modality of energy is what we call the adequate stimulus. Okay. So, for instance, the adequate stimulus requires the least amount of energy to activate a receptor. So what might be a really good example? You might have seen stars at a particular time in your life, when maybe you didn't even have your eyes open. All right, so you didn't have starlight entering your eyes and you saw like a picture of the heavens in your mind, but maybe you saw stars at another time. When is a time when you saw stars? Maybe with your eyes closed. You get hit on the head. Maybe you banged your head on something, unfortunately. Or somebody's, hit you, maybe they closed the door, or you stood up and there was something over your head, a lab cabinet or something, door was open, right? Bang your head, and then all of a sudden you see stars, right? So, or maybe you got hit in the eye with a baseball or something, if you're playing baseball or hockey or whatever, right? So there was a physical event that deformed the retina, so light didn't really cause that perception, but some change in the membranes and the retina caused depolarizations that ended up in action potentials that reached your occipital lobe, and you saw stuff, right? Okay, so in that particular case, that was not an adequate stimulus, and it has to be an above normal kind of stimulus to cause those receptors to send action potentials to the brain, right? It wasn't adequate stimulus. It was a higher than normal kind of energy. So all receptors can respond and send action potentials to the brain, but if it's not an adequate stimulus, it means what? It has to be a much higher threshold to get those receptors to turn on. Okay. All right, so how do receptors work? Because they produce generator potential. So here's another kind of potentials. You know RMP, you know graded potential. Action potentials. Here's another kind of potential. And we're going to learn in this class maybe one or two other kinds of potentials. All right. So a generator potential, here you can see in the dendrites of a nerve fiber, three different kinds of, all right, what kind of events would you call these right here? 1, 2, and 3. Are these hyperpolarizations or depolarizations? These are depolarizations, right? All right, and these might be due to opening of sodium channels, for instance. And all right, so these are graded potentials. So generated potentials are graded potentials. And in this particular case, these are all going to be excitatory. So these are what we would consider EPSPs. Right? And if this generated potential reaches threshold, then of course that's going to initiate an action potential on what, that initial segment or axon hillock of an axon, and then that action potential is going to reach the central nervous system. Okay, so this action potential is produced by what? An adequate stimulus which reaches threshold. Right, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. Right, proportional just means as the intensity of stimulus increases, then the intensity of a generator potential increases. And then after a threshold is reached, the action potential is frequency is proportional to the amplitude. So frequency coding is used to send stimulus intensity to the brain, right? Because an action potential, what's the intensity of an action potential? Does it change? No, it's the same every single time, right? So one action potential in your brain is like any other. The only reason why your brain knows that there's something different changing in your body is by the frequency of action potentials reaching that part of the brain. Okay. In phasic receptors, if you can remember what, that's the second kind that we talked about, the generator potential adapts to a constant stimulus and then quickly diminishes in amplitude. So it's the receptor that causes adaptation. It's not the neuron that fatigues or a synapse that fatigues. It's the actual receptor that you could think of as actually fatiguing if the stimulus is left on. Yeah. Yeah, so a graded potential can have different amplitudes. In this particular case, a generator potential is a graded potential that's being produced by some kind of receptor. So that's the big difference, a sensory receptor. So these are all graded potentials. How would you know that these are graded potentials right here? Because you see different intensities, right? And the intensity of these generator potentials is going to be proportional to the stimulus intensity. So generator potential number 3, right, has the highest intensity stimulus of these 3 that were applied. Okay. In tonic receptors, of course, the opposite happens. Right, you can have a very low intensity stimulus. So here we have a low intensity stimulus. It's going to produce a generator potential, which is sub-threshold, which then does not produce any action potentials. If we increase the stimulus, the adequate stimulus to a particular receptor, and we see that it reaches threshold, and it's then going to initiate some action potentials. But since it's just barely threshold, right, these action potentials are spaced far apart. And who could tell me why these action potentials are spaced far apart, knowing what you know about an action potential? Because what happens after the major event of an action potential? After depolarization and repolarization, what do you have coming after that? You've got that relative refractory period caused by that area of hyperpolarization, right? So this stimulus was threshold at one time, but since after every action potential, there is an area of hyperpolarization. This threshold can't overcome that area of hyperpolarization to reach threshold anymore until this time, right, which is delayed. But if you have a supra-threshold stimulus, right, it can overcome that relative refractory period, so action potentials are generated much more quickly as a result. And these reach the brain, and your brain goes, what? Oh, increased intensity, right? Because what do I hear? Beep, 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 right? So that's how your brain thinks in those action potentials. Okay, special senses. Well, let's name the special senses. Well, what's a terrible term? But I'll use it. Generally, what's a special sense? Okay, special sense, we got smell, and that is what we call olfaction, the sense of olfaction, or the olfactory sense. That's one. Taste, we call that the gustatory sensation or gustation. That's taste. And in order to smell something and taste something, guess what you need? You need receptors for those particular modalities. All right, so we got olfaction and gustation, hearing, vision, and then equilibrium. And there's two kinds of equilibrium. There's static and kinetic equilibrium, and different people talk about it in different ways. So I'll talk. So we'll define what the equilibrium senses are. All right. So taste and smell. All right. These are exteroreceptors as opposed to interoceptors. Right. Exteroreceptors respond to chemicals that are in the environment outside your body. Interoceptors respond to chemicals that are inside your body. So taste and smell respond. So these are also chemoreceptors. So chemicals have to stimulate these receptors, and these chemicals have to be within the environment someplace. All right, so taste or gustation you have on your tongue. And there is a structure called a taste bud. This is sort of a review from anatomy. All right, so here I can see a taste cell, and there are taste hairs or cilia that are on the apical surface of these taste cells. And then here is the sensory neuron that goes to the brain. And then there's some support cells. This whole structure right here is what we call a taste bud. And a taste bud probably maximally might be made up of about 100 cells. So we don't see all the cells right here. Maybe in some cases even a lot smaller, maybe 50 cells. So is this a structure that you can see with your naked eye? Can you see at the level of a cell with your naked eye? Absolutely not. So in order to see a taste bud, you need a microscope. But some of you might be thinking, well, you know what? If I stick my tongue out at myself and look in a mirror, I can see things that look like taste buds. Now, maybe you've never done that, okay? But you can look at the surface of your tongue, and it looks like there's taste buds on the tongue. But what are those things? Are those these things right here? No, those are what we call, anybody remember from anatomy? Those are called papillae, okay? And so papillae are covered with taste buds, right? You have thousands of taste buds on each one of those little papillae that you can see with your naked eye. And there's different kinds of papillae on different parts of your tongue. The bigger ones are in the back, okay? And maybe in anatomy you had to remember what the names are. There's circumvallate papillae, okay? But I think we're not so interested in that in physiology here, but I want you to know the physiology of these taste cells. And there's always some discussion what the sensations of taste are, but generally speaking, we can break them down into five taste sensations. So you have basically five different kinds of receptors on your tongue. You've got sweet. Guess what that tastes? That tastes sugar. Sugar molecules, right? Like what's a good sugar molecule? Glucose, sucrose. Right, would stimulate this kind of sweet receptor right here. Sour, okay, what kind of molecule is going to stimulate a sour receptor? Like an acid, right, like lemon, right, citric acid will stimulate these. Salty, guess what's going to stimulate a salty receptor? Which is sodium chloride, right, and when sodium chloride dissolves in water, like in your saliva, it produces sodium ions. Bitter. I forgot what bitter is. Bitter, something like quinine. And then some amino acids also can stimulate receptors, like glutamate, that stimulates a sense of umami, which is a sense of deliciousness, right? Gives you a sense of fulfillment and pleasure when you eat something. Okay, so, and when you taste something like a margarita, what do you taste? Well, kind of a mixture of all of these sensations, right? And so you can identify various foods by what combinations of these different senses. Some of you have never tasted a margarita, I can tell. That's what the discussion is. Yes, go out and have a margarita over the weekend. Okay? You can taste what? Sweet. You can taste a component of sour. You can taste a component of salty, if you order it that way, right? And so when you combine all of those senses together, then your mind can generate an idea of what it is that you're eating or drinking. All right, so these taste receptor cells are modified epithelial cells, right? Oh, here we say each taste bud can be made up of a maximum of 100 different of taste cells right here, right? And on a taste bud, they will have one kind of receptor on them, either salty or sweet or umami or whatever. So let's look at some of these different kinds of receptors. The first one is the easiest to appreciate. So here we have a taste cell, and on these hairs that are, or cilia that are projecting up, okay, into the taste bud, and the taste bud communicates what's within your mouth because there's a taste pore right here. So molecules have to dissolve in cilia and then move into the taste pore and interact with the taste cells. So if you're going to taste salty or have the sensation of salty, of course, you have sodium chloride in your mouth, namely sodium, and sodium can move, diffuse through a channel, a sodium channel, and when that salt diffuses through this sodium channel, which is always open, right, these are always open, what's going to happen to the electrical properties of this cell? It's going to depolarize just by putting sodium chloride in your mouth, right, and as it depolarizes, that's going to open up these voltage-gated calcium channels. The calcium enters, right, and then that calcium is going to cause the docking and the fusion and the release of excitatory neurotransmitter on this olfactory neuron right here, right? So that's going to cause action potentials going to the brain, and you're going to have the sensation that what you've eaten is salty as a result of that. So then if you block these sodium channels right here, what happens to your perception of saltiness? It goes away, right? You're going to be anesthetized to that particular modality. Or for whatever reason, your body stops making these sodium channels, right? Then this receptor goes away, and basically you'll be blind to that particular modality, which would be what? Salt concentration in your mouth. Yeah. Yeah, you singe these things right off. Yeah, so you lose taste sensation in that part of the tongue that you burn. Depending on how badly you burned yourself, right? And there's different ways to burn your, you can burn your tongue with chemicals, you can burn your tongue with temperature, for instance. Okay? So yeah, depending on those things, you can lose your taste sensation.
And then also, like in the elderly, that sometimes they can't take things as well as they used to.
Because they're missing these receptors. Okay. Yeah. That's just an age-related effect. And other chemicals that you might use in daily life might affect these channels as well. Different kinds of antibiotics, mouthwashes, things like that might affect the spectrum of taste that you have, right? Okay, sour is not due to sodium ion concentration. It's due to concentrations of hydrogen ions, which is acid. And again, there are selective or specific channels, proton channels, so that when you have an acid in your mouth, of course that produces protons, they diffuse into the cell, and what happens to RMP when a proton diffuses through a proton channel? It depolarizes, right? So that's what, that's an excitatory event, and that's going to cause these calcium channels to open up, and calcium then, of course, causes the fusing and docking of these synaptic vesicles, and that's going to stimulate this sensory neuron, and these action potentials go to the brain, and you're going to have the perception of something sour in your mouth, just due to this channel right here. Okay. What are some others? Well, our favorite, actually, receptors are the next, and those are the G-protein-coupled receptors. So all that time you spent memorizing the structure and how G-protein channels work, here's another really good example. All right, G-protein coupled receptors for sweet and umami. So molecules like a sugar molecule has to bind to a receptor that activates the G-protein. And G-proteins work by activating second messengers inside the cell. These second messengers for sweet and umami, okay, close normally open potassium channels. So when these potassium channels are normally open, what's happening to this cell? If potassium can leak out all the time, what's happening to it? It's hyperpolarizing, right? And if you close these channels, guess what happens? They actually depolarize, right? So you can actually depolarize a cell by injecting a positive ion like sodium or hydrogen ion. But you can also depolarize it by stopping hyperpolarization, which is an interesting kind of concept. So you stop hyperpolarization that causes depolarization, that releases neurotransmitter, right, and action potentials go to the brain. Okay, the sense of bitter, again, you have to have a molecule binding to a particular receptor. Try maybe tonic water sometime, which has quinine in it, probably most still do. That binds to bitter receptors on your tongue. That activates a G-protein-coupled receptor, which increases a second messenger. That causes an increase of calcium, and that calcium causes release of neurotransmitter, and then those action potentials go to the brain. All right, so this is an exam figure, right? So you got to know what receptors work by ion channels, which work by G-protein coupled, and by what mechanism they work. Okay, so that will help you memorize the different kinds of receptors. And I can't remember if I mentioned this before, but G-protein coupled receptors are probably the oldest class of receptors on Earth. Right, so these are what have evolved very, very early on. Most organisms have G-protein coupled receptors, and simple ion channel receptors like nicotinic receptors are a more modern, more advanced form of receptor. So we say G-protein coupled receptors are highly conserved. That means that we find them in all organisms. And we can actually use that as evidence for what? Evidence for evolution. Okay? It doesn't prove or disprove evolution, but that can be used as evidence for evolution because all organisms have G-protein coupled type receptors. All right, so when you drink that margarita later today, you should think of your favorite worm. Okay? Thank you very much. Okay. Olfaction, sense of smell. There are receptors located in the olfactory epithelium, right, on the superior surface of the nose. So who can remember this bone right here? Who can remember that bone? Not the part of the bone, but if you know the part of the bone, that's fine. Well, here we have frontal bone, and then just posterior to the frontal bone, you've got the ethmoid, right, and then in the cribriform plate, you have all of these olfactory foramina. That olfactory nerves actually leave your body. This is the only place in your whole body, and it's really a good thing, where you have part of your nervous system just dangling out in the environment. That's pretty weird. No other place would you want to have that happen. You'd like your nerves to be nice and protected, right? But here you have olfactory neurons just dangling down inside your nasal cavity. Okay, so let's zoom into this region right here. Here I see the nice olfactory foramina of that cribriform plate. And you have an epithelium. And these neurons right here, look at the shape of these neurons. These are bipolar. So typically we only see bipolar neurons in sensory apparatuses, like the nose is a really good example. So these are the olfactory receptor neurons. And we have support cells. And we also have stem cells in this area because you can imagine these neurons right here live in a pretty rough environment. Anything that you breathe in your nose have free access to these neurons. So they're short-lived. So these stem cells can replace these bipolar neurons, which is a good thing. Otherwise, you'd lose your sense of smell. Okay. So generally speaking, what have you learned about the regenerative property of nervous tissue? Is it good or poor? It is poor, right? When you have a spinal cord injury, oligodendrocytes inhibit regeneration. But here we have stem cells, nerve cells, stem cells. So it might be really interesting sometime if somebody can take these stem cells and do what with them? Maybe regenerate spinal cord neurons or something. I think that would be fascinating because the design of these neurons are what? To build new neurons. They're inherently programmed to do that. But that might produce kind of something weird. What might that produce something weird? Maybe your spinal cord can then smell things. All right, would that happen? Not necessarily because why? Because the neurons in your back aren't going to send action potentials to that part of the brain that's responsible for smell, right? So you have the consciousness of smell because the proper part of your cerebral cortex is depolarizing, right? So that probably wouldn't happen. All right, so what do we have? Well, we've got receptor cells, support cells, and basal cells. Receptor cells are bipolar neurons that send axons to the olfactory bulb. You can probably picture where that is. Right? These basal cells are stem cells that reproduce cells every couple months. So you can lose smell, and as long as these stem cells aren't damaged, what happens? It can come back, right? So, but unfortunately, as we get older, we lose our sense of smell anyway, probably because those stem cells population actually decreases. And the other support cells that we see within the epithelium are important for detoxifying other kinds of toxic chemicals that enter our nose all the time that are going to damage those bipolar cells. And in every particular case, guess what? It's our favorite kind of receptor. It's a G protein kind of receptor. And so an odorant molecule or an odor molecule has to bind to that receptor, which then is going to cause a depolarization, and then action potentials reach the olfactory lobe of the brain. And unlike taste that only has five sensations, there could be thousands of different kinds of olfactory receptors. And I could maybe show you a list of maybe the 10 most important, but it's so highly variable, there's not much agreement in the scientific community what the primary smell receptors are, what the primary sensations are. That is probably not too important to talk about. And just like in taste, right, it's probably also influenced by your environment. It's probably influenced by culture. So it's not just the receptors, but how your brain is taught to appreciate different tastes and smells as well. So that's one reason why it's really difficult to figure out. All right, so next time we're going to start with hearing and equilibrium and then vision. So I got the sign-in sheet right here if somebody still needs to sign in. Smell and taste work together, indeed, because you have